Session number 27341, Reel 5.
John, you like Reel 5? So how long were you at the fighter school?
I see that I ended on the 2nd of August. I didn't think it was that long. I went there in, what was it, April? Goodness.
I think you said April earlier on.
Yes, I went there on the May the 6th, that's right. And I actually was finished there on August the 2nd. This after I'd been down to St. Mirren in Cornwall and did some air-to-air firing, which I didn't do very good at. But and then I went on leave in August, preparatory to joining a squadron. And sometime in September, I went up to Admiralty, sometime later in September, to find out what had happened to my posting. And they said, oh, you're an 1840 squadron, what are you doing here? You just attacked the Tirpitz. I said, well, I didn't attack the Tirpitz. I was supposed to be on an 1840 squadron on Vic, I think, on one of the carriers, when they did a strafing of the Tirpitz. So I missed that one.
So you were lost in the post office?
Yes, they'd forgotten to give me. All the course instructors went on leave after the course finished. And, of course, I had to stay to do a bit of night firing, night landing. And then this was after I'd had my deck landings, because I did some deck landings on Argus in July.
Ah, could you tell me about those?
Yes. I went to Argus on the 19th of July and did 9 deck landings, two of which I pranged. And we'd been taught to fly and do all our dummy deck landings with Mark IV Wildcats, which had I think they were Wright Cyclone engine. And when we got up to Argus, it was equipped with Mark V Wildcats. Now, Argus was only a tiny carrier, and it had a very short and slim flight deck. And you had to fly very accurately. Now, we were all used to, certainly I was used to, putting the batsman on a certain point on the engine cowling. And when he was there, I knew I was at the right angle of approach. Well, of course, I was now with a smaller engine. So he was going to be floating somewhere above the cowling. Oh, God. So, of course, you instinctively sub him on the end of the cowling. Well, I was coming in too slowly, and they said, come on down a bit faster, you see. So I had to point the nose down. Well, where was this man supposed to be? Anyway, I had a couple of not bad pranks, but I caught... There are only 4 wires to catch. I think it's 3 in the Jesus Christ wire, which is what you said when you caught that last wire, because you always hit the barrier. I hit the barrier twice and punished the aeroplane a little bit. But they were all salvaged. They weren't ruined. And
what was the effect when it hit the barrier?
Well, you came to a very sudden stop, and your engine stopped, and the propeller looked all mangled, and the wiring was all smashed and stuff, so they had to... It wasn't really, but it was all tangled up with the engine, and... Oh, horrible. But I did catch a wire every time, but it was too close, you see, and hit the barrier. But at least it did stop the aeroplane to some extent. But twice out of 9, I caught a barrier. So I didn't do too well on that. But they passed me. And then we went to St. Mirren after that and did some air firing stuff against the drogue. And that's when I hit a drogue on the 29th of July. And it was... I had to go back to Yeovilton to do a little bit of night flying, just a week, and then went on leave sometime after the 2nd of August.
Can I ask, with these incidents that occurred, obviously like the incident with the drone?
Yeah.
How did you feel at the time with that? I mean, did it knock your confidence in any way?
No, not at all. I was just surprised. Shocked. Nothing bounced my confidence. I was entirely confident during those days. I knew I'd be all right. Just get on with it.
And your attitude to flying, were you really enjoying the experience?
Yes, loved it. Absolutely loved it. It was a very pleasant experience flying altogether. It wasn't something that worried me. It was self-indulgent as far as I was concerned. I was a happy boy flying. I didn't feel so happy when it came to carrier work, but at that stage, under instruction, I couldn't get in a plane fast enough.
Is that the case with all pilots, would you say? Or have you come across people who didn't really enjoy it?
No, I don't think everybody felt quite like I did, but I was enthusiastic and foolish and really did quite enjoy it. But I think that applied to quite a few chaps who found flying exciting and took to it. You know, some people didn't take to it. And although they may have become adequate, they didn't find it all that satisfying. You know, they were quite happy when it was all over and done with. But I didn't. I loved it. I thought it was great.
You just touched on carrier work there.
Yeah.
Am I right in assuming that the British approach to landing on carriers is differed from the Americans?
Oh, yes. Hugely different, yes. I mean, the American approach is largely from astern, straight down, and you have to land the aeroplane. The man gave you the cut when you were in the air, and you had to get down those few feet yourself. American aircraft in the main had good visibility. The Corsair, unfortunately, wasn't one of those aeroplanes. It had 13 feet of nose between you and the propeller, and it was quite a big engine. Consequently, you had to approach at an angle whilst you had to adopt a sort of tail down approach, and you had to be sinking down and turning at the same time, so that you turned onto the carrier virtually when as the batsman gave the cut. So it was a sort of a roll in, left wing down, all the way in, and straightening up at the last minute, when by that time you could see him, he was nearly abreast of you, and he gave you the cut.
Am I right in thinking that the Americans initially didn't want to use the Corsair for carrier
The problem was the Corsair oleo legs were badly adjusted, and they were far too hard, and they bounced easily. Consequently, when they landed, they'd bounce over the barrier, and they killed a lot of US pilots, Navy pilots, and I mean, really, they created mayhem, that aeroplane. It was just too hairy. It was such a big aeroplane, too. It weighed 7 tons, you know, just without bombs. And it did these strange tricks, like falling over on a landing and leaping over barriers and smashing into other parks of aircraft and killing people. So they didn't like it at all. Well, they gave it to the Navy, and a fellow called, I think it was Tritton, had the squadron in America, 1830 squadron. I think he was the back bloke who suggested adjusting the oleos, softening the the approach. So when it bounced, it sort of stayed down. It didn't give a heavy up, bounce back. And they adopted this approach, this slow rolling in approach, wing down, tail down. And you had to land about 2 knots above land, about above stalling speed on a Corsair, so that you weren't going too fast. And as it was, you were landing at about 88, 90 miles an hour. Was a bit hairy to begin with, but you got used to it. And they were such a nice aeroplane that I did have a couple of pranks landing on, but basically everybody did that. I liked it. To begin with, I found it a bit difficult landing, but it was usually due to my own stupidity rather than the aircraft being wrong. I mean, I had a scarf blew over my face on one occasion, and that, by the time I got rid of it, I found I was this way up, so I had to, from the deck's down there, so I had to sort of throw everything in the left-hand corner, and I was like that, and straighten up, and I caught my wing on the I caught a wire. Go on, hell, I caught a wire. And I banged my wing on the starboard after pom-pom position, which was the rear end of the island, and banged up the wing. But they repaired that. But that sort of the Corsair was very, very good. It was not liked by some people because it was such a heavy monster, but it really was a very nice aeroplane to fly.
With landing on a carrier, obviously when you first practiced it, and you mentioned that while you were on the Wildcat, and the arms looked quite small.
Yeah.
How does that feel initially? Because I imagine you're looking for a relatively small space.
You're landing on a small space. You are. When I did my first landing on this, on the Argus, I mean, it was, you know, rather like a merchant ship. It was just one flat deck. There was no island. The island was on a lift, which went up when the ship was steaming and sailing, but any flying, the lift came down. And the captain or the bloke who was watching was looking through a sort of little screen watching you and ducked down if anything was going wrong. It was a stupid moving carrier, I think. It should never have been allowed. But it was much loved by the Navy, and because, of course, it had a huge history. But that's where it should have been consigned well before I got near it.
Where did you go after? Obviously, you missed your post into your squadron.
That's me pranging a Corsair on a ship called the Unicorn in India, in Sri Lanka, Ceylon. One of our number had been killed the second landing, had been killed, and he was a New Zealander, and he was a friend of mine, and he'd landed and made a mess of it and went over the side, and we watched him drown, and I had to go off, next man off, and that's what I did. Prang the wing against the starboard. That's the starboard after pom-pom position. That's an aircraft gun there. And the wing just caught it. Because I landed badly at an angle, and instead of running up the deck, I ran across the deck. But it was well away from the barrier, just bad angle, that's all. They didn't hold it against me. But we're getting off track a bit.
Yeah, I was just saying, where were you? Obviously, you missed the squadron and the attack on the Tirpitz.
Yes.
Where were you posted to next?
Well, they said, where would you like to go? So I said, well, I'd like to go out in the Far East, if I may, because it'll be nearer home. Home being New Zealand. And they said, oh, yes, we can accommodate that. So I joined HMS King George V battleship in Greenock or Gurek, early in September, Or is it October? And went off to Ceylon via the Med. We had a week in Malta on the way, and we stopped at Alexandria. And then she was sent off to bombard an island called Melos, north of Crete. And there were three of us, plus a submariner on board. I think the submariner had got off. He was based in Malta. But we were going off to Ceylon, and so they kept us on board. Our job was air identification, friend or foe sort of thing, you know. And the funny thing was that I had a friend who was the Royal Marine lieutenant in charge of X turret, which is a two-gun turret, and on the front on the bow end of the KG-5, and he said, "Would you like to come and watch him bombarding?" So I was there with a periscope watching this bombardment of Melos, and they had this Melos had guns built into the cliff, two holes in the cliff top, and we were trying to hit it, and we never did, with 15-inch bricks. We bombarded the island, all right, but we didn't hit these two guns. And then we went back to Alexandria. It was a lovely trip up into the Aegean Sea, and glorious. And one of our members on the ship happened to be Alastair MacLean, and he wrote The Guns of Navarone. So I took part in the Battle of Navarone. it was a hoolie. But we didn't actually hit anything with the guns. I suppose the island could be counted as being hit, but the guns weren't hit, largely because the ship's log was not accurate, so it wasn't measuring the ship's speed correctly. Consequently, what they should have done was allow the turrets to fire by direct sighting, but he was trying to practice using the director equipment, and consequently his shooting was all over the shop and not at all well done. However, they had a bonny day throwing 15-inch bricks at this island. Poor defenseless Germans standing around there must have had a horrifying time. And then I went to Ceylon on to Ceylon on I think it was Euryalus, a little cruiser, and then to Putnam, where I met the Corsair for the second time, and did several hours flying. Where are we?
What was your feelings after, obviously you said the first time you'd seen it while you were in Canada, you thought, what a brute.
Yeah, what a
brute.
What
were your feelings that now you were going
to fly? Well, I was dismayed when I saw it the second time. I thought, oh my God, I'm going to fly Corsairs. I had no idea, of course, when I said to the Admiralty, send me out to Far East, I had no idea what sort of aircraft I might fly. I thought maybe I'd still fly Wildcats, you see, because we had no information, blackout on security. I mean, the press didn't report anything about tactics or aircraft flown or anything else, other than they might show a picture of an airplane and say, a Typhoon attacking French airfield or something. But other than that, the information that was passed about war activity was zero, which I still think is the best thing with wars. The less you know, the better. The less the enemy knows. So when I got to Rajalir, just the same as what happened when I went to Yeovilton, they put me into an aircraft that I'd flown before, which was the Harvard. And I did a bit of local flying with a fellow called Godfrey Parrish, who was the commander at Putnam at the time. He was He was a lieutenant commander, a famous chap. And I did 25 minutes flying with him. Then he put me into Wildcat, and I flew, although that's the Martlet, I flew that for a couple of hours. And then I moved over to the Corsair, which is a very easy move, strangely enough, because the cockpit layout and the instruments were not dissimilar from the Wildcat. It was only the flying characteristics which were quite different. But, I mean, this big burly brute, this Corsair, you had to swing him from side to side, a bit like a thresher shark. You know, when he's going through the water, he's swimming like that. Well, the Corsair did it, so the pilot could see where the hell he was going, because you couldn't see over the end of the cockpit. It was too big. So you taxied along, weaving, until you got to the runway, and then you opened the throttle, as blind as a bat, because you couldn't see what was in front of you. And then you had to bring her up and fly slightly nose up, because she had the biggest propeller of any aircraft. And you just hauled her off, and she went up like a bird. And she was a delightful aeroplane to fly. It really was. Although it looked heavy in the air, it lost all its weight and became... And, of course, it had a very powerful engine. It was a 2,000-horsepower engine. It really took that aeroplane up to 30,000 feet quite quickly, and very maneuverable. She'd roll, you know, just like a bird.
Did she have any vices in the air?
She had vices... she would stall very quickly. But you know, this inverted gold wing gave her a huge amount of stability. She was a wonderful gun platform. You could really sort of sit on your hunkers and aim your guns and get... and she was as steady as a rock when she was firing, too. That's another good thing. That weight in the aircraft gave you a hugely powerful weapon. And, of course, she carried two 500-pound bombs, or one 500-pound bomb and a drop tank. But and sometimes, of course, I carried napalm. We had our own napalm tank, which was petrol and detergent mixed together to make a jelly, and pumped into a drop tank, you know. It was normally used with petrol in it, fuel in it, to use as fuel for the aircraft. But with napalm on, of course, it had a phosphorus bomb attached as well, with a bit of string or a piece of wire, and you took this bomb off with you. And you had to drop it on the Japanese, which you did. You didn't think about it, really, but it was a nasty weapon.
How did you release it from the cockpit?
With the bomb. You had a release catch for your drop tank, your belly tank, you see, and you just pull that, you see, and it went down with its phosphorus bomb attached, and of course it was the phosphorus bomb that ignited the fuel. It made a mess. Whew, they were terrible things.
With the Corsair, you said it was a very good, stable gun platform. How many machine guns did it have?
Six 6.5s. That's a half inch. They were Browning machine guns. And the Americans... also had a gas patch on these things. We didn't know it at the time, but every one of those Corsairs had a gas patch, because the Americans were terrified of gas, and they used to have this gas patch, and when the aircraft ran through any combat zone, if there was any gas about, it would pick it up, and they could examine this patch. It was a piece of canvas, tacky canvas, and it would pick up traces of the gases. And in Yeovilton, and perhaps one day, have you been down to Yeovilton? You know the museum? Well, the Corsair in that museum has got a gas patch on it. Yeah, interesting, isn't it? And they've stripped it back to its wartime marking. And they were doing that when I was there last. And the curator showed me this gas patch, and I recalled it then. But it was standard practice for the Americans. I never thought that you'd have a gas patch on an aeroplane, but they are.
What were the markings in the Far East?
Well, we had these a white frame diagonal with a big white logo, roundel, and then a blue and white roundel in the middle of it. It was. Have I got a picture of it here? No, I don't think this one. Let's see, that's the old roundels there, which is just standard. But I don't know if you recall that the invasion task force flying aircraft in Europe had a particular big white and blue patch. Well, we had similar, but it was slightly different from that.
What about camouflage? Were your aircraft camouflaged?
No, we had. We had two colours. One was a dark blue all over, and the other one was the European mottled green and grey top with a duck egg underneath, a duck egg greeny blue on the belly and under the wings. And we had both. I don't think camouflage was worried about too much.
When you were operating in Ceylon, were there any differences in obviously climatic conditions than you experienced?
It was extraordinarily hot, and we had Fifi, the engine, the aircraft tractor, which was this elephant who used to. It was an extraordinary animal, really, because he didn't have any trouble pulling sea fires, because we had a few sea fires there, and not too much trouble pulling a martlet, which is a bit heavier, because you're only a little elephant. But when it came to of course, also the thing with the harbour that was there. And there was another thing there, a master, I think. Anyway, when it came to the Corsair, and worse, I think, there was a couple of Avengers there. It would fart, it would scream, it would shit. It simply didn't like it, and then it got it going, and it would then. You could see it was so proud of itself. It would raise its trunk up and wave it round and whistle and shit. It was a happy elephant. But it went through this performance every time. It was a hoot, really, to watch this thing pulling anchor. It was a bit unfair, I think. But they used it all the time.
What was the airfield like?
Very short. Quite good. We could only fly in the mornings because the afternoon the wind was in the wrong direction. So we flew in the mornings, and in the afternoons we sailed boats and did a few exercises. But basically, it was a pretty easy regime. It was all really flying. And then we were there only from. Let me see. We were there for 'til January the 24th, I see. Yeah. The last flight I did was from Unicorn on a Wildcat after my deck landings. And we left there soon after that and joined Unicorn and went down to Australia. And I mean, actually, on the course, I only did 44 hours before I actually joined a squadron. I mean, when you think about it, it's criminal. You wouldn't send your worst enemy off to do battle in the with that number of hours. And of course, I found it extremely difficult then to get into the routine of a squadron pilot, because I'd had no real training. However, I had to land on my first... I went to Nara in Australia. We got down to Australia early in